Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Young Kim. He is Associate Professor of Art History at the University of Pennsylvania and a visiting lecturer at the University of Zurich. And we're talking about his new book, Groundwork, A History of the Renaissance Picture. David, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks so much, Mark. I'm a big fan of the show, and it's a real honor to speak with you today and also about the book.
I have to say, there are very few art books I come across that actually sort of make me take a different view of artworks that I'm already familiar with, and this is one of those books. This book is a book that encourages, teaches a person to look at Italian Renaissance paintings in a different way, and I would say a more complex, nuanced way. Why did you write the book?
Well, Mark, it was very strange because when I would go to museums and galleries, and I know that you were teaching at the Worcester Art Museum for many years, when you go into the European galleries, you just see bodies, 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 bodies,
yep,
bodies.
Yep.
And when I was going to, let's say, the Sistine Chapel or even looking at slides with my students, I often noticed that, well, there's actually something happening both behind and below the human body. But how come we don't pay attention to the substantial part of the canvas or the panel, which is dedicated to the area around the figure? So I decided to somehow take a step back, take some time and really think about, wow, Italian Renaissance painting isn't just about the body, but it's also about the ground as well.
And I'm so glad you wrote this book because from my entire adult life, I've been fascinated by backgrounds, by what's going on in behind it, the figure. And I've always found that there's all sorts of interesting stuff that actually adds, but you know, it was all in my head. I would lecture about it, but it wasn't until your book that I really found a more systematic way to look at ground. As you write, there's no figure without ground. The figure is surrounded by something.
That's right. I mean, like Mark, I'm sure in sort of drawing on parallels with your work as an interviewer, I mean, when you're interviewing someone, there's so much that goes into the act of artistic creation.
Yep.
Beyond what we actually see on the page or in a film or in a TV show. And so what was really strange and what I realized which I should have known before, is that for artists, the ground comes first. That is to say, the artist has to lay down the paint first and then draw the figure. But for the viewer, we actually see the figure first and ignore the ground. And so just like an actor preparing a wall or an artist preparing a canvas, so too is the background often just as, if not more important than what we actually see on the screen or actually see on the canvas hanging in the museum.
Well, especially for Italian Renaissance paintings, I have to say art historians haven't helped the situation because it's all about the figure. It's all about the figure.
That's right.
And the evolution of the portrayal of the figure and blah, 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 blah.
That's right.
And there really has been a total sort of shying away from even looking at what it's on. Now, you have three different definitions for ground. And let's go through them one at a time.
The
material preparation of the planar surface, and a lot of people might not realize this, but that's actually a long process, and you detail it in your book.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for your listeners, if you think about just as you're preparing a soup base, you actually have to prepare those deep layers of flavor. And in a similar way, when painters are actually preparing a painting, you actually have to prepare the canvas. You have to lay down all these layers of what are called size and gesso so that the paint doesn't actually get absorbed by the canvas. So it's a real fundamental way of keeping the painting stable. But what I also was interested in discovering was how that very preparation somehow seeps through the layers of paint so that you're actually, just like a soup, you're somehow tasting those base notes in the soup. So too, are you visually seeing those base colors that pop out into your eye?
Artists still do that today, canvas painters. I mean, you can paint directly on canvas, and it has very specific effects. But if you want other effects, we still apply gesso. We still put gesso on canvases. One of the great things about this book is you learn a whole vocabulary of Italian Renaissance terms for artwork, too. There's gesso grosso and gesso sottile.
Oh, yeah, gesso sottile, yes.
Sottile. Yes. Hey, you're the Italian. Okay. What are the differences? Gesso grosso is like a much more textured, rough surface?
Right. So gesso grosso would be the thicker layer of this, let's say, plaster-like preparation, either on the panel or also on the canvas. And gesso sottile would be a thinner layer of gesso. So you would actually have to have several layers to somehow seal in either the panel or the canvas so that the paint wouldn't seep through.
Now, you also talk about colored grounds. Talk to me about that in detail.
Well, that was really a really fun part of the investigation, Mark, because I just assumed, you know, you go into a gallery, you see these bodies, but and this was something I gained from teaching students also at TAFA, that's the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts. And they would say to me, oh, well, Professor Kim, sometimes when I'm painting, I'm already thinking about the figure, even before I'm actually beginning to draw the figure. And I'm actually thinking about the color, the hue, the chromatic power of a particular body's flesh in a particular part of the canvas. And so these colored grounds are actually serving to give liveliness, to give chromatic depth. And if you think about how you perceive flesh in the world, flesh isn't just one color. It's actually a combination of colors, a combination of, let's say, of blood surging beneath skin. And so Renaissance painters were really interested in thinking about, oh, how can I as a painter represent the blood surging beneath the skin through preparing the ground?
Now, what did they use to color the grounds? Did they use other minerals and stuff like that?
It's really a fascinating history because we tend to think of this Italian Renaissance painting as being located in Venice or Florence or Rome. But all of these minerals were actually, many of them were not only locally sourced, but they were also imported. So, for example, one of the most important minerals, lapis lazuli, was used to create ultramarine. And that literally means beyond the sea. Huh. And it was actually harvested in Afghanistan in these mines. And due to the unfortunate circumstances in Afghanistan, there's currently a global shortage of lapis lazuli.
Wow.
And also the gold that you see in so many Renaissance paintings, that was actually sourced in gold mines in West Africa. And so what we call this Italian Renaissance painting, but if you think about the ingredients, we're looking at a global art, global art, which is actually being, let's say, exploited and put together by these Renaissance artists in workshops and forums.
So we've just talked about one definition of ground, which is the material preparation of a planar support. Your second one is where the figures place their feet in the world. The foreground, in other words.
Right. I mean, I mean, if you think about it, I mean, one of the definitions of what being a human is the ability to make one's way through the world by moving from, let's say, four limbs to two limbs. And if you think about it, in Renaissance painting, many of these figures are actually trying to walk through the world. Now, just acknowledging that that's very ableist language, but in the period in which I'm studying, they were very interested not only in walking, but also angels flying above the ground, figures going beneath the surface. And so we don't necessarily think about the figure walking through space when we think about Renaissance painting, but they're really interested in thinking about how do I engage with the earth, with the ground beneath the feet, with the sky above me, or with the ground, the subterranean layer as well.
And then finally, there's ground also designating the background.
That's right. I mean, often an artist will have been commissioned to, let's say, paint an image of the Virgin Mary. And you can imagine walking in these workshops and artists are saying, oh my gosh, another image of the Virgin Mary that I actually have to make. And so they would say, well, let me actually do some more, let's say, artistic and more inventive thinking in the background. And that's what Edith Wharton said, the American novelist. She's
I love that. You know, I love that quote from her. Talk about it. Yeah.
She was really interesting. She said, you know, for the real artist, the painting begins in the background, because if you think about it, these four Renaissance artists are doing, yes, another image of baby Jesus, another image of the Virgin Mary. And so it's in the background where I, as a painter, can do something different and interesting.
Right,
and something
right.
that will actually grab the attention of a client.
She described, I think, the foreground as the tourist site and the background as a hidden destination. And I love that contrast between the two things. We know everybody's going to know the Virgin Mary, so that's the tourist site. It's all the stuff that's going on in the background that is the hidden destination. And that's, you're right, that's where the artist comes through about what they're doing in there. And it's fascinating. It's always been fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm hoping to accomplish with the book is, like, you know, Mark, we live in a very fast-paced digital era. And I know this from teaching my students. And so what I would love for readers and listeners to do is actually look at a painting, spend some time, not only look at what the label tells you, but look at what the label isn't telling you, and take some time to think about, what is actually happening behind the figure, below the figure?
Exactly.
How can I spend, you know, we all live very, very busy lives. How can I spend maybe just one or two more minutes thinking about stuff that's happening behind the object or the principal object of attention? And so what this book is really about is attention and slow looking, somehow giving us, you know, a respite, a sort of a moment in our day where we can actually enjoy painting and really think about something else and sort of take time for ourselves and also take time for the paintings themselves.
I mentioned before, there's so many interesting words that you bring forth in this book. What is piano? I mean, everybody's heard of piano, but not in this sense.
Oh, right.
Is that where the word piano came from? I mean, is that the origin of the piano that we're familiar with?
Well, piano literally simply means playing in Italian. And if you think about the word for soft in music, piano simply means something that is sort of subdued, something that's that is actually a layer that is something that is layered, something that doesn't actually shout out in prominence. And so piano can simply refer to either a layer of paint, but what I discovered was that piano actually serves as the plane where these figures actually are walking through the world. And so, but what's interesting about your comment, Mark, is that I was thinking about this idea of, paying attention to these planes in Italian Renaissance painting is like listening to music. Sometimes when you're listening to very soft music, you have to listen even more closely.
That's right.
So too, do you actually have to somehow pay very close attention to what's happening on the bottom layers of a painting.
So is a synonym for piano terrain?
That's right. This idea of a figure, which is, and I'm not a great hiker. I don't really do much on the weekends, but that's maybe why I'm so attracted to these figures in Renaissance painting who are engaged in geological terrain. But these Renaissance painters weren't only thinking about, let's say, images of God the Father or the Virgin Mary flying in the air. They were really interested in how does the figure actually confront with these rocky outcrops, with these obstacles in the world, how does the human body, because the human body is a vehicle through which we experience the world. And so how do I, as an artist, represent the human body, which is walking over steps, which is walking across a pavement, trying to somehow go up and down stairs? That's a very difficult task for a painter. And so this is why I think the ground, which is fundamental, but we don't necessarily pay attention to it all the time. So that was a real fun part of writing the book.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Young Kim. He's associate professor of art history at University of Pennsylvania and visiting lecturer at University of Zurich. And we're talking about his beautiful new book, I should mention too, Groundwork, A History of the Renaissance Picture. There are so many great examples that you've chosen for this book, and I want to talk about one of them, one or two of them. There's a really fascinating picture by Titian, Portrait of a Lady.
That's right.
And there,
what's
happening in that is a really interesting thing that the artist has done about background, foreground, and the subject matter. It's like he's broken the fourth wall.
That's right. I mean, it's somehow you might want to think about, you know, again, a television show, which the actor is speaking directly to the camera. And in this portrait, it's a portrait of a lady. She's actually looking out towards us, and she's also grasping with her hand a sculpture relief of her own face. And so it's very strange, because not only is she making contact with you, she's making contact with a representation or a sculpture of herself. So it's really creating this hall of mirrors. You don't know where she is, and we are ourselves in relation to her.
It's really interesting. It's as if Titian was really playing with the viewer.
Absolutely. And what's really strange is that Titian even painted paint, and this is a little bit complicated. He painted a painting of a sculpted relief, but he also painted her blood vessels. And if you actually look very closely, one of her blood vessels is throbbing. And it's almost as though the sculpture is coming to life.
Wow.
In a similar way as the painting is coming to life before your eyes. So a lot of this Renaissance painting, we may sort of, our eyes may glaze over when we go into these Renaissance galleries, but there's so much going on in these paintings.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so animated. There's so much liveliness and visual play, visual inventiveness happening before our eyes.
But that's also, it adds depth to the meaning of the painting, too. Like, let's take this, there's a fantastic painting by the Circle of Bronzino, an allegorical portrait of Dante. Okay.
That's right.
What a wild painting, because there is a picture of Dante, but he's not looking out. He's looking back into the background. In the foreground is Purgatorio, I guess. And as a matter of fact, he's looking at a representation of Purgatorio in the background. So the figure becomes the ground in this painting.
That's right. I mean, it's almost as though, Mark, it's very strange that these painters, well, in this painting, this allegorical portrait of Dante, painter is actually painting a picture of a book. And what's fascinating is that you can actually read the script.
So you're, almost so as though your attention is immediately drawn to the foreground, not the figure.
Absolutely. And his hand is actually pointing and holding the book. And it's very strange because it's almost as though the body becomes the book and the book becomes the body. And it's almost as though, oh, okay, we're not only supposed to look at Dante, we're supposed to read Dante as well. And for me, the most exciting part of this painting is that, and again, I told you, Mark, that I don't hike and I don't do yoga either, but these painters and these Renaissance, you know, figures are always in these hugely contorted positions.
Yeah.
They're contorted in order to pay attention to different parts of the canvas itself. So it's almost as though you might want to think about the Renaissance figure as a series of traffic lights or a series of signals, sort of look here, look here, look here, and don't just look at me,
yep,
look at other parts of the painting as well.
What you have a fantastic chapter on gold ground. And I'm sure people who have been to any kind of museum that has Italian Renaissance painting has seen these paintings where the figure is really obvious in the middle and the background is done in gold leaf. And typically,
right,
the lecture you get on this is, well, you know, they were just sort of reproducing an otherworldly effect of divine light in transcendent space and an echo of paradise in timeless space. You quote all the tropes in your book,
right,
but you know, there's a lot more going on to the gold.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what was really fascinating, just as I mentioned in the previous part of the conversation, is that a lot of this gold was sourced from West African mines. But what's also interesting, and I don't know if any of your listeners have actually worked with gold leaf, but it's extremely difficult substance to work with.
Yeah.
And it's also fascinating because gold is very soft. And so what happened was that these painters would actually use gold itself as a surface on which to inscribe and mark patterns.
And so if you really look at these paintings, you'll see that they'll take needles.
Absolutely.
And sometimes they'll do raking light effects on the gold. There's a lot of going on there.
Oh, absolutely. We have to imagine, Mark, that a lot of these paintings would have been in cathedrals, they would have been in small churches, or even in your home as a Renaissance viewer, and you would light candles before them. And so lighting the candle before the gold crown would have added this extra dimension of animation. And we can imagine that just as the light was flickering across this golden surface, the light and the play of light and shadows would somehow make the image come to life, such that as you would look at the image of the Virgin Mary, it would be as though the Virgin Mary was somehow had this lively presence in your own home. So again, we might think of gold and this metal as being lifeless, but far from that, this gold and metal was actually serving to make the painting as lively and animate as possible for these devout viewers.
You also mentioned one writer, one art historian, who talked about don't ignore the fact that it is gold. It's a metal that has prestige, it has weight, it's important in the world. And that's also brought out by sometimes the gold leaf was made by Venetian ducats.
Oh, yes, absolutely. These gold coins were actually... it's really funny because in some cases these painters could be sued if they didn't actually use gold leaf that was actually sourced directly from gold coins themselves. So this is a way of guaranteeing the authenticity. In the Renaissance we have so many funny stories about painters who are actually stealing ingredients, painters who are actually going over to the monk's refectory and eating too much of the expensive cheese. We have all sorts of, crazy and funny stories about these Renaissance painters. But again, I mean, on a more serious note, these materials were vital. And I guess one of the major points of the book is that these artists aren't only interested in depicting the figures, they're interested in understanding how materials work in the world. So again, just as a cook knows how to use olive oil and onion and actually create such fantastic chemical combination that makes a great stew, so too do these painters know how to use gold, know how to use lapis lazuli, know how to use various paints and pigments in order to create these amazing works of art.
We only have a few minutes left, and we've barely touched this book. But I have to mention, you spend an entire chapter sort of analyzing in detail a fantastic painting. Giovanni Bellini's St. Francis in the Desert. What an incredible painting to be talking about background. You couldn't have picked a better painting. That, first of all, people should look that up as we're talking right now. Bellini's St. Francis in the Desert. My first reaction is, where's the desert? Because there's too much other stuff going on in the background. And the other thing, my immediate gut reaction is, he's become part of the background. The figure is shrunk,
right.
and he's in there among these very complex things of rocks. It's an amazing picture, and that has a lot of detail of geology in the background.
Oh, absolutely. And what's so interesting is that desert in the 15th century didn't necessarily mean a place that was absent of life. It literally meant a place away from the city, away from civilization, where you could actually pray and devote your time to God. And what we see here is St. Francis, who is actually experiencing a moment of epiphany. His head is raised. A tree is bent that's being bent due to the force of light, which is actually on the upper left-hand side. And what we're seeing is not only an image of St. Francis. We're seeing a particular divine moment. And yeah, I just encourage your listeners, next time they're in New York, to go over to the Frick Madison on the Upper East Side, because what's so beautiful about the current installation is that there is a trapezoidal window that actually reflects light on the painting itself. And you can actually spend quite a few minutes, if not an hour, with St. Francis himself in the desert. But that's right. He actually becomes part of the desert as well. His form is actually, it's almost as though the desert becomes like a plane of liquid wax that is absorbing his body.
And there are so many important details to look at in the background. Just one. His pair of sandals that he's not wearing at the time is tucked underneath his lectern. I mean, and that's just like a throwaway detail.
I mean, again, it's so interesting. It's about a moment, because it's almost as though St. Francis was praying in his study and he experiences this divine moment. And
yeah,
he rushes
yeah.
over to see what is going over there. And so just as, you know, when someone is ringing the doorbell, you somehow... you cast off your shoes, or you sort of leave your jacket on the table. So too, it's like, oh my gosh, what's happening over there? And that's actually a very interesting point. I never realized that. That in fact, moving over to the other side of the painting actually calls our attention to another aspect of ground that I didn't get to in the book. So this conversation is very helpful. Maybe I'll write part two.
Oh, I would love that, but we're all out of time now. My guest tonight is David Young Kim. He's an associate professor of art history at the University of Pennsylvania and visiting lecturer at the University of Zurich. And we're talking about his new book. It is a wonderful book, and it'll really change the way you look at art. Groundwork, a history of the Renaissance picture. David, it's been a real pleasure.
I learned a lot from this conversation. Thanks a lot for the chance to talk about the book.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.